feedback that I got that was pretty uniform was, we want you to talk about aging. So I'm going to talk about aging. That's the subject for tonight. This is going to be a super fast little hors d'oeuvre taste of a very big subject, actually. But I hope it will be somewhat useful. If you want to delve into it in more depth and detail, I'm offering a 3-day non-residential retreat at Spirit Rock in August, and I brought flyers that will tell you more about that. Spirit Rock is starting to do more non-residential retreats in the community hall, and this is one of those. So it's a 3-day retreat, really, and I will run it as much as like a retreat as possible, with practice, silence, precepts, refuge. So it will really be, there'll be some talking, of course, and teaching, but a real chance for your own reflection, your own connection. Yes. Okay. So, anybody aging? Anybody not aging? You haven't decided. You know, when we're young, we're all aging, and we kind of know that. But when you're young, you just have a different experience of aging than you do after you turn. I like to say 60 is the kind of moment when it begins to dawn, oh, it really is true that we age. You know, for a while it seems to only happen to other people, but then when we hit 60 or we see the wrinkles or the gray hair or the low energy or loss of libido or whatever it is, however it comes to you as a very personal teaching, it's like, okay, well, sure, everybody's aging, but me, this body, wow, that's a whole different kind of like, oh, wow, how am I going to do this? So I'm going to talk about 4 challenges of aging, and I'm going to talk about this to you, and I'm assuming that you are all practitioners of meditation and Dharma. So I'm not talking about just aging, I'm talking about the consciousness that we can begin to work with as we age, because that's what's, as practitioners, that's the most important thing. Not the fact of aging, but how are we relating to the aging, and how can we use it to our benefit as practitioners? How can it help to actually wake us up? That's what's important. So one of the very first things that I noticed, and perhaps you as well, is the diminishment of energy, the slow diminishing of the ability to push yourself beyond, you know, reasonable limits to get the job done or to drive to New York or, you know, do something that requires big energy, and you just, you know, what happened? Where is it? You know, where did it go? And you're not able to summon it as readily as you could when you were young. And the loss of energy often means that we go more slowly. We're not racing around so much because we just don't have it in us to do so. And I used to, when I lived in New York City when I was a young person in my 20s, I used to see these old people sitting in the park, and they would just be sitting there, just like, you know, bumps on a log, just sitting, and they're like watching things, you know. And I think, oh, get a life, you know, why are you just sitting there? And now I can think of nothing nicer than just kind of sit and not do anything. You know, there's a whole kind of appreciation of, it's not meditation exactly, but it's kind of a reflective mood. It's pleasant. Your body's comfortable. You don't feel stressed. You know, you can just open to life happening all around you. And it's lovely. So the body slows down. The mind also has its own life, right? As we age, the mind does things that we may feel upsetting, like we can't remember somebody's name or how to do something. We'll bump into these times where we feel, wait a minute, the quickness of conversation kind of, we're a little bit confused. We don't know what's being, you know, we're not so quick on our feet to think of the right answer, whatever. So there's a kind of slowing, there's a kind of emptying of our many moments where we're not thinking of how to fill it up. Although I would say that some older people, and maybe they're not practitioners, when you have a practice, you have an excuse. You know, you can just sit down and breathe and feel like you're not completely, you know, a bump on the log. You're doing something productive. But many older people, if they don't have some kind of inner discipline or consciousness of their consciousness, try to get busy. You know, fill your time. That's sort of one of the culture's antidotes for aging. Keep busy. Fill your time with hobbies and grandchildren, and don't waste a minute because you won't be here much longer. You know, that's a solution for some people. But I like to think that in the meditative world, we have different solutions. And it's more about emptying, understanding that we don't have to fill our time, that we can actually open to a more spacious, less busy life. And I hope that sounds good to you. Maybe it doesn't. It's challenging to lose your energy. You just don't have the energy to do some things, and maybe it's tied in with your identity. However, the gift of it is that mindfulness practice, which we're all practicing here, thrives on slowing down. What do people do when they come on retreat? They slow down. That's even why they come on retreat, so they can have some legitimate reason to slow down. Because in slowing down, what happens? You notice so much more. You notice what is missed when you're filling your time and your mind and your body with activity. You miss a whole lot. So the gift of mindfulness is, and the gift of aging, is that you have time to open to things that you haven't seen before, you haven't known before. You can be curious, you can be interested in emptiness itself. You know, the Buddha talked a lot about emptiness. Are you interested? It might feel like, oh, this matches my actual experience that life is actually not as solid and permanent and as, you know, we may have thought at one time. So aging gives us slowing down time. Then the question becomes, how are we going to use that slower pace? How can we benefit from the slower pace? Can we be content with being less busy? Ask yourself that question. Do I have to fill my time? What does it challenge in you to not fill your time, but to use your time well, to breathe, to connect with your heart, with your body, with other aspects of your life? There's a book I saw recently by Katagiri Roshi called Every Moment is the Universe. If you're rushing around, you're not going to notice that title. It won't speak to you. If you're slowing down, if you're breathing, if you're entering into a relationship with your own being, every moment is, it may have some, like, it may call you, like, what is, what? Wow, what's that? You may have even glimpsed the sense of that. So part of slowing down also is that we are losing what Eckhart Tolle calls our outer purpose. He makes a nice distinction between outer purpose and inner purpose. And he says that when you age, when you turn 60, I think he uses that age as well as a sort of dividing line. It's not really a dividing line, but it, you know, you have to, you can make some distinctions there. So he says most of our adult life is about fulfilling our outer purpose, the roles that we have taken on to make money, to raise a family, the roles of worker, boss, lawyer, fireman, secretary, whatever it is that we have devoted ourselves to fulfill our obligations, to support ourselves, support our families, the roles we've played in our family, of husband, wife, mother, father, cousin, whatever roles you have played, those are all represent the outer purpose. And what's significant about the outer purpose is it's more like the things that are assigned to you to do. The outer purpose doesn't necessarily reflect your choice, but something you're good at that is practical and fulfills your obligations. He says, aging gives you the chance to let go of fulfilling your outer purpose. You've done it. How many of you in this room, over 60, you have pretty much fulfilled your roles, right? Your outer purpose is done. It's complete. Now, and in India, they recognize this. They let people over 60, they're set free from their householder responsibilities. In India, they're free to wander. And in India, there's a whole tradition of wandering wise people. Sadhus, they're called. They can just leave behind everything and go pursue their spiritual destiny. That's because India has that as a core feature of their culture. The importance of one's spiritual life is recognized. So we don't have that. We have people in motorhomes driving around. That's as close as they get to wandering, you know, going to the parks, and they're searching for something. I don't know exactly what, but they're out there driving around. And, you know, in the Buddhist world, people in Thailand and Burma, they would go to the monastery, spend more time at the monastery in pursuit of their spiritual life. We have retreats. And I just taught a retreat for people 55 and over. It's such a rich time to practice because of the losses that are being experienced directly. You don't have to convince somebody over 60 that impermanence is a real thing. They know it. They see it in the mirror every morning. Yeah. So the turning towards something else other than your outer purpose, your roles, what you've done already in your life, it's done. It's done. Do you feel that? Those of you over 60, you can let it go now. But mostly people, it's a little fearful maybe to let it go because it's a source of identity and attention and the loss of those roles can provoke an identity crisis. The loss of those roles, people have the question, who am I now? My children have grown up, and nobody needs me in the same way. Who am I now? So, for aging, that's a sort of frightening question. Well, I guess I'm nobody, you know. But in the spiritual world, that question is like one of the best questions you can possibly reflect on. Who am I really? It's the question of identity is seen as the centerpiece of the Buddhist teaching. It's the centerpiece of our problem that we think we know who we are. We identify with me, mine, myself in a fairly limited way. So asking that question as you're getting older is a has the potential for liberation in a very visceral, real way, because you have done your worldly duties. Now you're free to liberate yourself. For some people, that's a potent goal. For others, it may not be. But that is the gift of this turning towards the inner purpose. So, okay, turning towards the inner purpose, what is that? How does that look? Well, you could ask yourself the question, what is calling me? You're not an empty vessel. You know, something, you get up in the morning and you have some ideas or something feels like, oh boy, I really want to take that painting class or I want to volunteer for climate change something, you know. You feel called. It's your choice. Something you choose. How fantastic. You get to choose what you want to give yourself to. What you want to attend to. And it's your choice. So that's the inner purpose. And it may also have something to do, the inner purpose may also have something to do with the sense of limited time. You know, death is not, it becomes a little less abstract. The hard part, here's the hard part about death. Well, maybe there's other hard parts, but this, the first hard part is that, okay, we kind of know we're going to die, kind of. We know other people are going to die, but we kind of know we're going to die. But we have no idea when or how we're going to die. This cannot be known. But it sort of freaks us out, doesn't it? You don't know when you're going to die. You might die tonight. The first time I taught here, a woman keeled over. Do you remember that? We had to call the fire department. That got a little too close. She did not die, but we didn't know that. We never knew who she was even. Anyway, death can come at any time. So that's one of the reflections. Death can come at any time. And we hear stories, don't we, of people keeling over. Done. So we don't know when we're going to die. We don't know how. We'd like to. Maybe we have an ideal vision of our death. And now people are writing out the extensive advanced directives about how they want every detail. They want to be at home in their bed with all their loving friends and family present, and everybody chanting and singing. And well, maybe not. Might not turn out that way. So it's quite a deal, isn't it? But in any case, the idea of death becomes somewhat more real, and we see that maybe there's things in our life that need completion. Maybe there's things in our life that need healing. We need to heal certain relationships as best we can, or situations, or we need to complete with our children or something, so that if we do die, we won't be racked with regret that we didn't take care of things. There's two words in the Pali language, hiri and otapa. Some of you know. Hiri means regret. The Buddha didn't talk so much about guilt. He said guilt is not useful. But regret is a good thing, he said, because it means we're recognizing that we did something wrong. We just are recognizing, yeah, I blew it. Otapa is remorse, where we not only have regret that we did something wrong, but with remorse we're saying, I will never do it again. So it's kind of clean. It's not like mea culpa, beating ourselves up in some sort of, you know, way that doesn't ever end. Hiri and otapa show us a way to say, yes, I regret that I did that, and I, because of the clarity of mind of seeing that, I know I will never do that again. That feels really good. So you're letting yourself know that you have learned something of value. So that might be a part of completing. Okay, the third challenge, and it's no small one, facing death. And part of facing death is understanding what is death. People have all kinds of ideas about death, partly influenced by childhood, how you grew up, the beliefs of your parents, the religion you grew up in. But what do we really know about death? What is it exactly? So I like to say this. Okay, let's get very basic. What is it that dies? The body definitely dies. Let's be clear about that. The body loses its ability to be alive. It dissolves. The elements that keep the body alive dissolve. Earth, air, fire, water dissolve. And we are no longer, the body is no longer alive. But what about the mind? What about consciousness? This is where it gets really doo-doo-doo. Who can say for sure? Nobody. We can make educated guesses. We can listen to wise people who've looked into this matter. In some countries, if you're a Buddhist, it's a belief that you're taught that consciousness continues. In the West, we're not taught that. So we have a harder time kind of like going there. But in the Buddhist tradition, the mind is a centerpiece of practice. The idea of working with our mind is what brings us into meditation, does it not? Because we see that the mind is not controllable exactly, but we can work with it. It's workable. The monkey mind, and the mind that is full of difficult emotions or moods or thoughts, beliefs, ideas. So we really, meditation gives us a way to work with the suffering of the mind. There's a saying, who is my enemy? Who is my friend? My mind is my enemy. My mind is my friend. And one way to describe meditation is as a movement from the mind as enemy to being with a mind that you have befriended and that you can work with. The mind can be an ally, because at the same time the mind gives forth difficult emotions and mental states, it also brings forth the beautiful qualities of heart and mind, of compassion and love and generosity and acceptance and patience. And it also has these beautiful capacities. So we're wanting a mind in facing death, especially. Very important. What kind of mind are you with as you are dying? Of course, we want to be with a compassionate, kindly, loving. We want that atmosphere as we're dying. And part of that can come certainly from people around us, but also a large part can come from our very own heart. Our heart mind can help us die peacefully. So if we have completed our business with people, and we've developed qualities of heart and mind that are like allies, then that's what will be with us as we die. Then there's the lamas saying, then you will have no problem with death. So what is death? Here's some ideas. I'll read some descriptions and see if you can guess who said them. Death, when we consider it closely, is the true goal of our existence. I have formed during the last few years such close relations with this best and truest friend of mankind that this image is not only no longer terrifying to me, but is indeed very soothing and consoling. And I thank my God for graciously granting me the opportunity of learning that death is the key which unlocks the door to our true happiness. Who said that?
Mother Teresa.
Nobody has ever guessed when I've presented this, because it's surprising, actually. But let's hear some more guesses.
Walt Whitman.
That's as good as anybody.
Harry Truman.
Just kidding. We won't even ask how you came up with that. Okay, who else?
Well, you said it was somebody unlikely.
Yes. That's true, Harry Truman.
Harpo Marx.
Oh. Actually, I'll just tell you, Mozart.
Oh. Could you read it again?
He died at
I won't read the whole thing because he thanked my God for graciously granting me the opportunity of learning that death is the key which unlocks the door to our true happiness. Maybe he knew he was going to die and it brought up real happiness in him about life, you know, because that can happen when you get a death sentence. Sometimes it brings forth your better qualities. Okay. Here's one. Wait a minute, seeing death as the end of life is like seeing the horizon as the end of the ocean. David Searles, contemporary author. Let us deprive death of its strangeness. Let us frequent it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing more often in mind than death. We do not know where death awaits us, so let us wait for it everywhere. To practice death is to practice freedom. It sounds awfully Buddhist. Montaigne, the French philosopher. Here's one I like. Never say about anything, I have lost it, but only I have given it back. Is your child dead? It has been given back. Is your wife dead? She has been returned. She was on loan the whole time. You just didn't realize it. We're all on loan, right? So that was Epictetus. Here's one, more contemporary. Of course you don't die. Nobody dies. Death doesn't exist. You only reach a new level of vision, a new realm of consciousness, a new unknown world. Henry Miller. And I'll end with one from a lama. When death finally comes, you will welcome it like an old friend, being aware of how dreamlike and impermanent the phenomenal world really is. Dingo Kensi Rinpoche. And by the way, I brought with me tonight this book, I don't know if any of you have seen it, called In Love with the World. I recommend it to you because it's the story of a lama, a young lama named Mingzhu Rinpoche, who wanted to deepen his practice, so he ran away from his monastery. He literally left in the middle of the night and didn't tell anybody where he was going. Anyway, it's the story of what happens to him, and it involves a close encounter with dying. It's a very beautiful book, In Love with the World, a monk's journey through the bardos of living and dying with Mingzhu Rinpoche. It's really good. It was Helen Twarkoff pretty much wrote the book, but it's his experiences. Anyway, okay, so challenges of aging, slowing down, losing energy, losing our edge. If you ever had one. But old people lose their edge in the competitive world of capitalism. Turning from the outer purpose to the inner purpose. Facing death. That means also facing impermanence. Opening to the impermanent nature of your own life right now. And fourthly, coming into a new relationship. Well, let me put it this way. When you're older, you see that the past is gone. Have you realized that? It's never coming back. Even though sometimes older people like to think, you know, they can recapture their youth. That can be a goal. But it's not coming back. It will never be the same. You know, I feel the loss when I see the movie about Woodstock. That's sort of my thoughts about, oh my God, it'll never happen again. That was so great. You know, we need another Woodstock. That's what we need. No, it's not coming back. So, the past is gone. What is the future like as you get older?
Less of it.
There's less of it. And it, anybody else? What is the future like?
It could be scary.
More acceptance, less judgment.
Well, that's a very positive future.
More ease.
Okay, but the future itself.
Some really crummy housing policies.
The future itself is uncertain. Yeah. It could be great. It could be really hard. It could be really terrible. I mean, have we ever lived in a world this uncertain? Have you been watching anything? You know, gives you a great feeling of solidity and security? Probably not. And as you get older, maybe, you know, when you're young, the future holds promise, right? Upward and onward, and there's promise and vision and enthusiasm. What is the future like as you get older? I don't know the answer. I just think it's a great question.
Less choices.
Less choices. Mm-hmm. And you don't know how much you have of the future. Like I said, death can come at any time. My future might be for two days I have left, you know. Or the future could be another 30 years. Please, God, no, thank you. I didn't really mean it. But you don't know. So the past is gone. The future is uncertain. There is only the now. There's only the present moment. That's it, folks. It comes home in a new way as you get older, that's all there really is. And it's right now, right now, right now. Fleeting, insubstantial, but alive. So the Buddha said something that I want to read to you. Where is it? So you can sit here watching a fumbling old woman who can't find her papers. This is part of it. You get to be so embarrassed in front of people because you're obviously incompetent. That's the way
it
is.
Just like me.
Yes, just like me. I know I have this here. It's just hiding at the moment. Okay. Well, maybe I didn't bring it. That really shows my incompetence. Oh, no, here it is, to the rescue. Okay. So the Buddha was living at Savatthi in India, where he gave this teaching. He said, "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? But one who dwells thus ardently, continuously, by day, by night, it is he or she, the peaceful sage has said, who has one fortunate attachment. One fortunate attachment is the present. If that's where you're attached, that's pretty good, because that's where practice reveals its treasures, is in the present, nowhere else. You can't find what you're looking for by thinking about the past. You can't find what you're looking for by imagining it happening in the future. It's only ever here, 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 now. And from the moment we sit down to meditate, we are beginning a new kind of exploration where what is valued and pointed to is this, right here, right now, the present moment. We're not looking to the past for explanations, nor are we looking for a better plan for the future. But instead, we are learning the value of letting go of past and future, and instead being curious about what is here, right now, in the immediacy of our direct experience. This is how we learn what the Buddha taught, by studying, being in touch with the present moment. Something can be found in the present that cannot be found anywhere else. Not in the past, not in the future, not in a book, not in someone else's enlightenment experience, but only in the present moment of your very own experience. But we undervalue our experience. We don't think it's, so I'm breathing, so what, you know? But the more that we practice and the more that we look into the present, the more things begin to open up. We begin to get like, wow, it's all here. So I'd like to share with you 10 things about the present moment that make it a compelling object for our attention. I want to sell the present moment. 10 ways that can help you. It's where we are most alive, where life is happening. This is our life right here. We learn to be present in the present by gathering our attention, by collecting ourselves and creating a stability of focus, a stability of mind. And this allows us to think and feel with greater clarity. If we look at the present moment with a scattered mind, we won't find much. We need a mind that has a clarity in it and a stability to be able to see one moment unfolding into the next. All the great achievements in the human world rely on this human capacity for unwavering focus of attention. All the great discoveries have depended on people with clear minds who can sustain their attention for more than a few, you know, nanoseconds. We're creating a culture of distraction. This is not useful. We learn the value of being over doing. On doing, when we're just doing our lives, we're sort of on automatic pilot. We may be multitasking, getting a lot done, but but we're not there. We're not not present, we're not reaping the benefit of what's in here. We're not trusting the unfolding process of life. Fourth, in the present moment, we can discover what we have overlooked, because when we're distracted, we don't see much of what's here. So the more present we are, the more we have the chance to see what we are ourselves overlooking, and that is misperceiving what's actually available. Fifth, being in the present teaches us that we don't need a lot to be content, that we don't need a lot of stuff and activities and achievements and awards to be have a sense of well-being, that we can be very happily nourished and content by just being here. It gives us something that nothing else does. I think the koan for our times is, when is enough enough? Because we live in a culture where enough is never enough. There's a subtle teaching about you should want more. More stuff, more activity, more doing. You need to improve yourself, more perfection. You know, it just is endless. At some point, we may catch on and say, wait a minute. Right here, it's enough. This breath, this sound, this sight, this smell, this taste, this being here is so totally enough. It's what fills you the most. But we have to find that for ourselves. The other thing that comes up with being present is that we begin to appreciate awareness as having more potency and power to show us what's true than all the thoughts in the world. We cannot think our way to enlightenment. Many have tried. We can read all the Buddhist books and be no closer. And sadly, I hate to tell you, but that's the truth. So Ajahn Amaro puts it this way. He said, trying to think your way to enlightenment is like trying to drink water from the word cup. Isn't that good?
Yes.
It really captures it. Awareness is the hidden power of the present moment. We won't find awareness by thinking about it, or by, you know, creating a theory about it. We only, it's always here, but we need to find it as in our direct experience. We can only contact the past or the future through thinking. We can only contact the present through awareness. Does no good to think about the present. But to be aware of the present is the direction of our practice. And awareness is the great antidote to our busy thinking mind, because awareness can see the mind, can shine its light and say, thinking, oh, I'm thinking. Being able to see that you're thinking without getting lost in your thought is a huge and liberating step in your practice. When we're lost in thought, we are lost, period. But when we're aware of thinking, we are not lost. We're here. We're seeing something of great value. Okay, the present moment is the birthplace of insight, and creative problem solving. Deepak Chopra says, I do not worry about the past, and I'm not fearful of the future, because my life is supremely concentrated in the present. The right response comes to me in the immediacy of what occurs. It's a way of knowing that is trusting of awareness to show us what's true. Now we're up to number 9, so there's 2 more points I want to make. Being in the present reveals impermanence and change like nothing else. You can see the impermanence directly. Sounds arising and passing, thoughts arising and passing, everything arising and passing. 10. So, in the present moment, something happens to time. Time disappears. And when time disappears, you disappear. You and time have been married, you could say. You think that you're moving through time, that that's who you are. You were born and you will die. And that's a certain view of the self. But in the present, that disappears. There is no story that you need to hold on to about yourself. In the present, there's only seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, thinking, awareness, all moving through you, but not as you. So another way to say this is no thought of self appears. A Tibetan teacher calls it the deathless zone of total presence. There's no birth, there's no death, there's just what is. Being present reveals the empty nature of what we call self. When you are dying, this is a good thing to remember. There's no self dying. There's just phenomena appearing and disappearing. So in all these 10 ways, we can see that the present is really our teacher. In the present is where we look to learn and to grow and to understand a lot about life and about ourselves. Anyway, I hope some of this has been interesting to you and that it will be beneficial. It's hard to do quickly. So if you want more, come to the 3-day at Spirit Rock in August, because we really, part of what's so valuable is you all having a chance to speak about your own experiences. So that's what in part will happen in the 3 days. But I need to stop now because we have some metta cards, right?
Yes.
Diane, you're doing everything tonight. So how do you feel? Do you feel like aging is more interesting than you realized? I hope so. That's my hope. Okay.